So first of all, thank you very much to CCC and SIGINT for accepting my talk late. The talk was accepted about a month ago, which means, you know how it is when at a conference and you're making a presentation and you've got all your slides ready and you know exactly what you're going to talk about, and then something happens, which means you have to make a few changes. So the last 3 weeks have been the most intense time for me in about 13 years of working on intelligence and surveillance law and policy and privacy. And I'm going to try and tell you the story of how, with some other academic researchers, last year we published an analysis for the European Parliament, which kind of anticipated PRISM. But to begin at the beginning, I want to make a few preliminaries. As some of you know, I was chief privacy advisor for Microsoft up until 2 years ago. I'm delighted not to be that anymore. And I'm now an independent for privacy rights. And the first thing to say is I did not know about PRISM when I was at Microsoft. Probably not surprising. I would expect maybe only 20 people in the company know about PRISM because it's top secret, no foreign eyes, classification, all about it. But I've actually been warning about the danger of FISA Section 702 for the last 2 years. And it's been kind of hard to get people's attention, I guess, up until the last 3 weeks. I've never had a security clearance. I don't trust Microsoft an inch. I'm now also 100% free software advocate. And I'm not going to talk today about why I left Microsoft. Maybe I'll talk about that some future occasion. So what this talk is really about is cloud computing. And I think a lot of journalists used the term cloud computing simply as somewhere to store your photos, some sort of remote disk store. But I think probably everybody here understands that its structural significance for the IT industry is much deeper than that. So what this talk is about is cloud computing as parallel processing power, as a commodity. So the consumer services which are sort of associated with cloud typically are Facebook and Skype and Microsoft and Google. But I'm really more interested in the surveillance impact on business cloud computing services like Azure, Office 365, and Google Apps. And on the left, you can see a modern data center. And on the right, you can see a doorway which has the number on it, 641A. Does anybody know? Stick your hands up if you know what that means. OK. So you could summarize this talk really by saying, is there one of those in one of these? And to tell the story, we have to go back a decade and recapitulate some of the probably forgotten history about what became known as the warrantless wiretapping affair in the United States. And around about 2003, an AT&T technician called Mark Klein, some men arrived in his switching center in San Francisco with badges from the NSA, and they said, we're going to build a new room and a new installation in your switching center. And he did some digging around and discovered that they were basically splitting one of the main fiber optic cables for the western seaboard of the United States, carrying both domestic and international traffic, diverting this to a Naris box, sort of top of the range deep packet inspection box, and presumably triaging in real time and diverting some part of that traffic to the National Security Agency. And he and other whistleblowers, they went with their stories to different media outlets who refused to publish their stories. And in fact, the New York Times did finally break the story in 2005, but only after sitting on it for a year. Meanwhile, the 2004 election in the US had happened. And without recapping the whole story of all the other whistleblowers in general, they tried to go through official channels and then the media, and then they were ignored and in many cases prosecuted. All of this created something of a scandal in the American media for about 2 years, which raged until around about 2007. Most of this activity was legalized by an interim piece of legislation called the Protect America Act. And that introduced retroactive immunity from lawsuits for the telecommunication companies that were involved, which could have amounted to billions of dollars. And it really cemented a sort of new paradigm of collect everything and worry about whose traffic you're allowed to look at later. And in a sense, I'll discuss in a second, it meant, in this sphere, the end of particular warrants on particular targets. And instead, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court The secret court set up in 1978 under the first FISA Act approves procedures, which we'll go into. So the first thing we have to get clear in our minds is the definition of foreign intelligence information. This is the crucial concept defined first in FISA 1978, which has been inherited pretty much unchanged subsequently. And this is what we're going to be primarily concerned with. And you can see in the complex definition up there, grayed out, there are the things that you might expect: sabotage, terrorism, hostile acts of a foreign power, clandestine intelligence. But there's also this. And when you unwind the definitions, it comes down to information with respect to a foreign-based political organization or foreign territory that relates to the conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States. So that's incredibly broad. It can be just about anything of interest to US foreign policy. And incidentally, foreign-based political organization, when you sort of look up the provenance of that term, that doesn't have to be a political party. It can be essentially any kind of campaigning activity, ordinary, lawful, democratic activities of Europeans in their own countries, which might be of interest to US foreign policy. So in 2008, the Interim Protect America Act was replaced by this, just before Obama was elected. And it's got two numberings, rather confusingly. When it was being legislated, the numbering was 1881A. Now it's been consolidated into the FISA Act. Its numbering is 702. So if you see anywhere 702, 1881A, same thing. So this law authorizes the collection of any foreign intelligence information. It intentionally targets only non-Americans outside the US. When I say only, that's 95% of the world. That's the rest of the world. It gives a blanket authorization for 1 year, and it requires a minimization of the access to that information with respect to US persons, that is American citizens or legal residents of America. The providers have to give all facilities and information to do all of this in secrecy. It's a contempt of the FISC court for non-compliance. And the providers, again, have complete immunity from any kind of civil lawsuits. That's very relevant for data protection, because if, for example, a European cloud customer had a contract, a so-called Article 17 contract, with a US-based cloud provider, well, they wouldn't be able to enforce any damages or penalties in American courts under that contract. And all of this has to be done in a manner consistent with the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment, as I'm sure you all know, is that famous part of the American Constitution which guarantees that you cannot search someone's person or papers without a warrant issued on probable cause. And probable cause means a criterion of suspicion of guilt. It means, is there about 50% evidence to suggest that this person is more than 50% likely to have done some crime? So in summary, this 702, it combined three elements for the first time, which had been there separately in previous legislation. From the Protect America Act, it got this idea of targeting the rest of the world, but not Americans. And then something that really nobody noticed was the insertion of three words: remote computing services. And this term had actually been defined in ECPA 1986, but all the previous Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act stuff, including stuff in the Patriot Act and Protect America Act, hadn't included these three words. So the effect of this was that this law no longer just dealt with interception of communications by telcos and ISPs. This reached inside the data centers of cloud computing and essentially allowed that information to be sucked out from the inside. And of course, the significance of that is that encryption of communications to and from the cloud using SSL then becomes kind of irrelevant, at least against this threat. And thirdly, you have this breadth of definition for foreign intelligence information, which we've just reviewed, which essentially authorizes purely political surveillance, nothing to do with criminality or even, strictly speaking, national security. And it has this feature which I call a double discrimination by nationality, because not only is the law specifically excluding Americans as targets, But even in the definition of foreign intelligence information, where it says relates up there, well, if you were a US person, that would be necessary. So necessary, a very strict legal criterion, relates, a very, very loose legal criterion. So it's my view that this double discrimination, strictly according to nationality, if that were attempted by any country in Europe, that would be completely unlawful under the European Convention of Human Rights. We'll come back to that. So what about the Fourth Amendment? I haven't got time to go through all of the sort of detective story here, but the current doctrine, which I think after Snowden is now well known, that the Fourth Amendment does not apply to the rest of the world, that really wasn't clear. And in fact, the doctrine really only started from about 1976. And then there was a court case in 1990 at the Supreme Court, which sort of didn't completely establish that for these circumstances. And then in 2008, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court did issue a secret judgment, which was only released a couple of years later in redacted form, which was about the Protect America Act and also the very newly passed FISA Amendment Act. And that contained this line that there is no Fourth Amendment for foreign powers reasonably believed to be located outside the US. And there are a couple of other signs there that one can find in Freedom of Information Act requests. But I'm now going to play you a video clip because I think it's very difficult in Europe to appreciate the political climate in America if you haven't worked for a big US corporation or if you haven't spent quite a lot of time in America. This clip is from a congressional hearing by the House Judiciary Subcommittee last year, where they were discussing precisely the FISA law, which was coming up for renewal. It was expiring. In fact, it was renewed between Christmas and New Year this year. So this was a hearing by to hear from civil liberties advocates in the US. And to give you a bit of background, one of the people you'll see is Congressman Trey Gowdy from Texas, and the civil liberties representative is from the ACLU, Jamil Jaffa, who is doing a bang-up job of contesting FISA. But, well, see for yourself.
Let me see if you and I can agree on something. Does the Fourth Amendment apply to foreign targets in foreign lands?
I don't think that's the question presented by the
No. That's my question. So I promise you it's the right question, because that's my question. Does it apply?
I don't think it does.
When you say you don't think it does.
Well, in the circumstance of this statute, I don't think it does. Right. I mean, we certainly haven't made the argument that it does.
Does the Fourth Amendment, I'm not talking about a statute, I'm talking about, does the Fourth Amendment apply to foreign nationals in foreign lands?
It does not.
Does the Second Amendment apply?
I don't know
the first,
the law, but I think no.
Eighth?
I think it would depend on the circumstance.
Women's suffrage, does that apply?
No.
Okay, that's my point. They don't. So we're not talking about surveillance of foreign nationals in foreign lands, right? Because you don't think there's a constitutional
communications.
That's my second point.
So he's being sort of browbeaten and bullied, basically, to admit that he has no legal case for arguing for the rights of non-Americans constitutionally. If you're not American and you're outside the US, you simply don't have any privacy rights with respect to the FISA law. So some of this, not all of this, was put into a report which I wrote with some academics for the LIBE Committee of the European Parliament and was published around October, November last year. And it sank without trace. These reports to European Parliament often only read by about three people, if you're lucky, and there was simply no reaction whatsoever. It was on the website, in plain view of search engines, no comment, no reaction whatsoever. So I was watching the renewal of the FISA law between Christmas and New Year on C-SPAN, as you do, and I just got fed up. So I started trying to call up some of my journalist contacts, and it basically proved impossible to get any interest from the European media, particularly the British media. And then a very good journalist, Ryan Gallagher, wrote a very tight 800 words for the Slate magazine blog. And it's kind of ironic that the story had to break on an American blog. But it did, and we then got some coverage in the French press, the German press, and then eventually the British press. And there were about 1,500 tweets on this in a week. And the general reaction, from one can infer, was, what on earth is going on? How can this be possible? What on earth is the point of this edifice of data protection law if it cannot protect us from foreign intelligence spying by a non-European state? The reaction on US blogs is much less, but one self-described civil libertarian said, the Europeans are upset about this. How strange. Well, who's going to stop us? The political reaction in Europe was minimal. The same very good usual suspect MEPs, particularly Sophie Intervelt, took the report seriously. And then there was then a hearing in February where we presented the report to the Libor Committee. When I say presented it to the Libor Committee, there were only three members of the committee present. And I tell you, it does slightly make one's heart sink when you get ready to do your presentation and you think, wow, okay, I can make my case now. And then you see half the MEPs get up and leave just as you begin. And you're left really with an auditorium, you know, full of staffers. So there was a fairly clear warning actually I gave about this back to whoever was present to the European Parliament in February. But again, almost no reaction. We've had a dramatic confirmation, of course, since all the PRISM revelations, and one of the most significant has been something I never really expected to see, but there was a leak on the 20th of June in the Snowden material of the procedures, the 9-page document called Procedures Used by the NSA to Target Non-US Persons. And essentially, it's a lot of bureaucratic nonsense. It confirms that there are no substantive privacy protections for non-US persons at all under the FISA law. It's solely concerned with establishing the foreignness or the likelihood of the foreignness of the target, and there's no restrictions in there on the full breadth of foreign intelligence information, which I pointed out earlier. So how did this happen? How did almost the entire official regulatory structures of Europe somehow get mesmerized for 5 years not to see this happening? So there has been, for want of a better word, an organized campaign, which I call CloudWash. And the structure of the argument in these propaganda documents is always the same. It's to say that US law provides good protection for its citizens under the Fourth Amendment, in many cases, at least equal or better than the protection in certain European countries provides for its own citizens under its own laws. Therefore, don't worry about European data in American clouds. Well, you can see the fallacy of that, because when you put European data, or indeed any the rest of the world's data, in American clouds, there are no privacy rights whatsoever that are applicable under this law. So some of the reports that were generated in the sort of past 3 or 4 years and trying to sort of analyze the cloud situation, there was a 5 myths document from the US mission to the EU, no mention of FISA. A law firm called Hogan Lovells seems to have been acting almost as a proxy for US lobbying. It's not really clear on behalf of whom. I've asked them several times who pays their bills, and they won't give a straight answer. They produced a report last year which looked like a sort of solid piece of legal research, but it was actually full of omissions and distortions and misrepresentations. The European branch of very well-known law firm Linklaters again produced an analysis of these risks, no mention of FISA 1881A. Peter Hustings, the European Data Protection Supervisor, one of the most, if not the most respected figure in European data protection, who has been very solid on things like data retention. He gave a speech to a Brussels conference of the Business Software Alliance, probably the sort of the core lobbying organization for American business interests against data protection. And he gave a green light to essentially transfers of European data into American clouds in a way which would not provide any guarantees against this sort of thing. ENISA has produced a couple of reports. Again, no mention or inkling that this might be some sort of threat. The World Trade Organization, RAND Europe, got a very juicy, fat commission to write the European Commission sort of official study into cloud benefits and risks. No mention of FISA. And there's also been now an academic project, long running at Queen Mary University London, with some very distinguished data protection lawyers involved, sponsored by Microsoft, and there's only one mention of Pfizer in one footnote in all of those many papers they've now produced. This is an extract of a speech from the outgoing ambassador from the US to the EU in a speech he gave in December last year. And I'm sorry, I always put too much information on my slides, but in brief, what he's saying there is that the protections in criminal law have not been changed by the Patriot Act in respect of non-US citizens. And that's true. Of course, what he doesn't tell you is that the protections for non-US persons were eliminated by Protect America Act and then Pfizer. So it's, I think, there's no other word for it. It's a deceptive presentation of the issues. It's a legerdemain. It's a conjuring trick. This is a diagram produced by the ACLU in 2006, and what they did is they took some of the documentation that the whistleblower Mark Klein brought with him about the installation of the splitter in AT&T San Francisco, and they were able to extrapolate from some of the serial numbers and the docket numbers on that to infer that it probably didn't just happen in San Francisco, that these kinds of splitter taps would have been installed in most of the other major internet exchange points around the US. So that vividly sort of came up with this term of the NSA surveillance octopus. And so why this slide is titled "This is not a request" is when you look at all of the policy materials by data protection authorities, by the European Commission, they always refer to requests from a foreign government as if there will be some due process, some particular piece of paper produced, due consideration given to that, and then some approval given. Well, this is not a request. This is a state of continuous scanning, mass surveillance, and diversion of data. There is no due process involved here. But this idea of continuous mass surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes, it simply doesn't appear in any of the documentation or the concepts of European data protection authorities. Is cloud surveillance a real risk? Well, I guess since about 3 weeks ago, we have to say yes, it is. And I've already made the point that encryption of data to and from the cloud, if you want the cloud to process data for you rather than just store it, well, the significance of this unnoticed three words in 702 was that it now reaches inside and it can compel service providers, cloud service providers, to do the wiretapping from the inside. And in my view, the most important sort of type of cloud computing for the future is platform as a service, something like Azure or Google Apps, where you rewrite the software in new languages like Hadoop. And then if you do that, then it means your application can scale almost instantly to thousands of machines to cope with very, very varying dynamic demand. So you can imagine the world turns, a customer service call center wakes up in a different time zone, suddenly it's hit by thousands and thousands of calls. So this is a very attractive way to write your enterprise software to cope with that sort of fluctuating demand. But what's going to be the impact on surveillance? Well, if you wanted to tap all of this with DPI boxes, you'd almost need 1,000 DPI boxes on standby, because all of those boxes are then going to have to reconstruct the protocol stacks from all of the layers of information that you're interested in order to do that wiretapping in parallel. Or, well, you coerce the service provider to do the wiretapping in software. And for every subroutine that's called, every data transformation, well, there's something that also scans that data. So I don't know if that's been done already, but it seems to me a clear implication of if governments want to be able to wiretap the cloud and platform as a service, then they're going to have to essentially put that into the software fabric. And 702 gives them the power to do that. They can simply order Google or Microsoft to rewrite their software in order to implement this. So I guess the difference from the Echelon debate is Echelon was really talking about the threat from interception, whether that's interception from microwaves or indeed interception from undersea cables, which was already being done back then. But you can protect communications with encryption in principle. But the significance of sort of industrial and business cloud computing is that the American technology giants, they want to win the contracts to process every last scrap of European data, whether that's for governments or for banks. So this essentially puts all European data at risk, not just that fraction which we were communicating and sending at risk of interception, as with Echelon. And in fact, there's already a spec. In fact, this spec comes from the European telecommunications standards industry, which is coined the term lawful intercept as a service, LIAAS, which is using the cloud to surveil the cloud. I mean, it's a very elegant idea, but it's not, as it were, theoretical. So meanwhile, in the maneuvers leading up to the new data protection regulation, the big cloud companies and data protection authorities knew they had a problem. They knew, really, there was no way to inspect what was going on inside cloud data processing, but they had to sort of maintain some sort of legal formalism to allow this data to be exported. So they got together. They started having little huddle working groups from about 2009, and they came up with this concept called binding corporate rules for data processors. So again, I don't have time to go into all of the legal detail, but the rough idea is that Microsoft or Google would go to a security auditor and get some sort of rubber stamp for a security audit on the entire platform. Once they've got that, and they tick the other boxes for the BCR, the data protection authorities all over Europe must accept that. They can't quibble and cavil as, for example, the German data protection authority has commendably done over Safe Harbor, as far as they can. And then that data can all be transferred to a US-controlled cloud. So of course, when you simplify it like that, you can see that there's a conjuring trick here. Any question of foreign mass surveillance disappears into a puff of audit. And Article 29 Working Party wrote an opinion about this on BCRs for processors last year in June, and they have this very curious statement that the audit coverage might, for instance, include decisions taken regarding conflicts of law. For instance, you'd think they'd want to be rather specific about that. Leaving that ambiguous seems a fairly recklessly dangerous thing to do. And a newsflash for DPAs, lawful access under FISA-type laws, that's not in the threat model of commercial security auditors. If you got one of the big five commercial security auditors and they knocked on the door of room 641A and said, what's going on in here, can we see? They'd be told, no, you can't see what's in there. In fact, you're not even supposed to know this room exists. And if you tell anyone about it, then we might hit you with espionage charges because you'd be telling a foreign government. But even aside from that sort of conceptual flaw in the way in which data protection authorities have approached this over the past 4 years, when you look into the detail, there are some loopholes already built in. So it says in the BCR document that this request from a foreign government should be communicated to the data controller unless otherwise prohibited. Well, guess what? FISA does prohibit it. And the request should be put on hold, and the DPA should be informed about it. Well, that's just not very credible. If you're Steve Ballmer or Larry Page, and you're thinking about which law to obey, and you have the prospect of some fines from these vague and ponderous European authorities who seem very, very far away, or your American corporate attorneys are telling you that if you obey these European regulators, well, aside from the billions of dollars of reputation damage you might suffer, you could certainly be in contempt of court, and you might even be guilty of espionage charges. Under the Espionage Act, telling a foreign government about any of this is, in fact, a death penalty. I mean, that's what it says. I'm not saying that's likely, but that is, in fact, the literal position. So the point of this slide is to show that, on the left, there are three categories of information that we're concerned with. There's straightforward criminal law enforcement information, there's national security information, and then there's this wider, open-ended category of information purely for foreign policy advancement, political surveillance. And then what we've got in the green zone is to show that intra-EU, both of those two types are fairly well covered by legal agreement. Political spying from one European Union state to another maybe shouldn't happen, but probably does. But the red zones, transfers or exposure of information to do with national security or anything that's really interest to US foreign policy, it's not protected. It's not protected by the Fourth Amendment. It's not protected by EU data protection or by Council of Europe Convention 108 or the Cybercrime Convention, chance to be a fine thing. And of course, it's out of range of the European Convention of Human Rights. Incidentally, many of you will know that the British Information Commissioner, our British Data Protection Authority, is possibly the worst in Europe. They published an opinion about guidance on use of cloud computing last October. If you read all of this bump, it basically says if you comply with a FISA or Patriot order, you'll get off scot-free. They have sort of preemptively said they don't intend to enforce any data protection in respect of these transfers. So what do we know about PRISM? I've only seen the same reports that you have, and we still haven't seen the full set of slides, but some points I've picked out. They do refer to selectors or search terms designed to produce this 51% confidence in a target's foreignness. That exactly corresponds to the FISA analysis we did in abstraction last year. And then there's this other element of the reports that were probable cause with respect to non-Americans just becomes a sort of criterion of nationality. Very, very bizarre idea that you have a court that has transformed the idea of criminal guilt into simply a criterion of nationality. And then in the UK, we've had a little bit of sort of sidetracking where the politicians got hung up on the issue of is GCHQ making use of PRISM? And it seems to me that's not the main issue. The main issue is that America has this unilateral surveillance power over any European data. We also don't know, are there any other programs with different code names than PRISM also using this 1881A 702 law? There may be. For example, the business use of cloud computing, which I referred to earlier. The reports we've had of PRISM are all really about consumer-facing services. So we just don't know if there is indeed another PRISM-like program, or there will be in future, essentially designed to do with the scanning of all of that business type of cloud processing. There were some denials from some of the main companies, and there's a very curious concordance of phraseology between what Facebook had to say and Google had to say. Something that you might think would be very hard to happen accidentally unless there was some common text which they both based their replies on. And then very shortly afterwards, we had confirmation from the Director of National Intelligence that PRISM is indeed all about 1881A. That is the law which has authorized all of PRISM. So something very, I think, interesting has come out of the evidence given to US Congress by General Keith Alexander, the current director of the NSA. And as you will have gathered, this talk hasn't been about the Patriot Act. When you read about Patriot and FISA as if they're all mixed up together, it's very complicated. But yes, Patriot did amend certain parts of FISA, but not the parts we've been talking about. The parts we've been talking about happened in 2007 and 2008, and had actually nothing to do with the changes made to Patriot, made to FISA by Patriot in 2001. However, what has been in the news, of course, before the PRISM leak, the day before, there was the leak about the order to Verizon, which gathered up all of the metadata for phone calls for all of Verizon's customers, and we presume for the rest of the US telcos as well. And this was done under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which was originally sold to Congress as being about accessing library records. And it's also now emerged that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court first approved this concept of gathering up all of the metadata, blanket collection of metadata, as far back as 2006. So this has a very strange implication. So the reasoning of the FIS court was that for legal reasons going back 20 years previously, they had decided that there was no Fourth Amendment protection for metadata. So all, if you like, of the associational privacy of Americans, who is talking to who your friends are, what the social structure of your relationships is, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court decided none of that was worthy of protection. And so what do they use this metadata for? Well, General Alexander, in his testimony about 2 weeks ago, said he talked about putting it in a locked box database. So they interrogate this database, if they have a telephone number that's of interest, to basically try and find out from 5 years of traffic history whether that number is likely to be about an American. And you can see how a machine learning algorithm would make a pretty good job of that. If you've got an exemplar set of Americans and their traffic patterns that you train on, an exemplar set of non-Americans and their traffic patterns and you train on that, a learning algorithm can do a pretty good job if you're only after a 50% probability. So that's the way they do it. They consult the locked box of metadata for the entire country to make essentially this 50% call on whether somebody is an American and thus whether they're deserving of Fourth Amendment protection. If they are, then a particular warrant in that person's name specifically justifying that surveillance has to be obtained. If not, then blanket access is possible to the content. So that's where, if you're the rest of the world, you're out of luck. All of your content can then be analyzed and examined without any further particular warrant requirement. So the irony, it seems to me, and I guess it's no secret, maybe they kept this with a no foreign eyes classification, is from European eyes, this seems sort of doubly disturbing because, yes, the Americans have had blanket data retention, as have we since 2006, but for a totally different reason, an incompatible reason. The Americans have had blanket data retention in order to preserve Fourth Amendment protection for their own citizens by nationality. And making that discrimination purely by nationality in terms of the European Convention of Human Rights would be completely unlawful. So the raison d'etre for data retention in the US is not just completely different, but ideologically wholly incompatible with any possible defense or use of data retention in Europe. It does seem to be somewhat ironic. So some ideas. What can we do? In the data protection regulation, back in February, when I did the presentation to the Parliament, that created a sufficient stir that I was able to get basically two ideas for amendments tabled. They're not as strong as I would have liked. They were somewhat diluted in the drafting, but they're all that could be done at the time. One idea is that if your data is going to be transferred, particularly to American clouds, you should get a big fat warning box. A pop-up red warning that says, abandon hope, all ye who click here. If you let your data out, you will have no protection under European law against a foreign country's intelligence agencies spying on that data for political purposes. Please click here if you agree. So that's designed to have a political effect. And of course, I intend that also not just to apply on services that you use directly, consumer services. I intend that to apply to business use of cloud computing or government use of cloud computing, where, as it were, they've already got your data. So they would then have to get back in contact with you and get your approval with such a strong warning. So of course, it's going to be criticized as impractical, but it's designed to have a practical political effect, a drastic one. And the second idea is so that really the only, I think, way that we can be sure that the US or indeed other countries are not doing this is to encourage and protect whistleblowers. So back in February, really not knowing anything or anticipating what we've had in the last 3 weeks, there was a draft, again, it's not as strong as I'd have liked, which does say that data protection authorities have a duty to organize amongst themselves ways of protecting whistleblowers, ways of receiving and treating their information sensitively so that they are given as much legal protection as possible. And we need to encourage that. In fact, my original proposal was to give whistleblowers 20% reward of any fines subsequently levied. As nice self-financing proposal, because we can't really expect all whistleblowers to be as altruistic as Snowden evidently is. I think ultimately we can only solve this by changes in US law, which actually give full reciprocal recognition to European human rights. There is some now debate about the so-called lost Article 42 in the draft data protection regulation. Just before the final version was published in January, there was a leak in November 2011, and that leak contained this article which said, if you get a foreign request, then you've got to tell the data protection authority and the data subject. And I guess that's okay, but I just worry that the European Parliament is going to readopt that as a way of making itself feel better. And then the question you have to ask yourself is Steve Ballmer or Larry Page actually going to obey that? Or are they going to basically kick it to their lawyers and say, let's deal with that down the road, these crazy Europeans, when no way we're breaking American law in this. And then I think we also have to think about reform of data protection authorities. This is something that is not part of the current data protection regulation agenda. It's assumed that everything is fine and dandy with data protection authorities. Their role is going to be solidified in the new data protection board. It's going to turn into an even more bureaucratic empire. But we have to ask ourselves if virtually all data protection authorities simply blinkered themselves to this problem for the past 12 years. Why should we have any confidence that they will be able to deal with these issues? It's a cultural problem in the way that data protection authorities are intensely bureaucratic, almost devoid of technologists, and prone to being politically overruled, even though they're supposed to be independent. And I think we need a lot more European and national level advocacy within Europe based on a proposition that human rights are universal and they cannot be discriminated by nationality alone. We reject completely the idea of data retention, blanket data retention, either of content or metadata, and we say that for law enforcement and national security, data preservation must be targeted on people about whom there is some human rights justifiable prior reason. And there was a speech that Carl Bildt made to a Swedish internet forum about a month ago, which I think nicely typifies the doctrine of much of the government establishment in this area. And he was at this internet forum being asked about the problem of mass surveillance, and this was before PRISM, problem of mass surveillance and freedom of expression. And he said, oh, no, we mustn't confuse these two issues, because, of course, the point about secret mass surveillance is that it's secret. If people don't know that it's going on, then there cannot be any chilling effect. And if there's no chilling effect, there's no problem for democracy. That is really how they think about it. That is, I could say quite a lot more about the sort of philosophical underpinnings of that. But that is the way they think about it. And I suppose at least one can say, well, if nobody knew about it then, they certainly do now. So that's all I have in the presentation. Of course, I'd be delighted to take any questions. Thank you very much for your attention. So yeah, the question is, how does the idea of a warning box relate to, well, the other aspect of the risk, which is it's not just about the location of the data, it's essentially the ownership of the company. Slightly paraphrasing your question, but to take the two parts of that separately, I mean, the idea of the warning box is essentially to shock people. It's to say, I mean, in some sense, one can think of data protection as being an anesthetizing ideology. Data protection is based on a very silly idea. The idea is that if you've got some data in the custody of one entity, and you copy that data, and you give it to another entity, and you copy it again, and you give it to another entity, and again, providing you've ticked all the legal boxes, the privacy risk to the individual is unchanged. And that's obviously nonsense. But that is the entire, as it were, legal philosophy underlying data protection. When we talk about cloud companies, I think it matters quite as much the ownership and nationality of the management. And frankly, I think it's unlikely that a European company with European management would get served with a FISA order, because the Americans want to keep this secret. I think they still want to keep it secret, even though it's not. We'll have to reevaluate that. But certainly up until 3 weeks ago, it was said that it would be unlikely that a European company would get a FISA order, just because the European lawyers working in that company would probably put up a much better fight for the rights of non-Americans. Whereas you've seen from the clip what the sort of attitude is to privacy rights of non-Americans within the American body politic. So when you have data in clouds that may be physically located around the world, but essentially the control center operating that cloud by remote control is going to reside within US jurisdiction, then yes, it's very easy to suck data out from clouds which might be in Europe or in Singapore or any other part of the world to comply with the FISA order. So you have to worry not so much about where the disks are and where the cloud's data center is, but where the locus of control is from the management of that company. And the point about consent and the big red warning box is, well, I mean, if if people really want to send their data in jeopardy of political surveillance, I guess you can't really stop them. All you can do is warn them in the starkest possible terms, and you hope that at least by creating that very, very strong warning, you'll get a much stronger ripple effect than the dead cat bounce we've had so far.
Hello. Thank you very much for your talk. I wonder if you thought about the cooperation of European governments or with US government and NSA. Today we read in Spiegel about the cooperation of BND and NSA. If they do, would your strategy be out of order?
So that's a very good question. There was an interesting document which I just saw today. In fact, it's been around for 3 years, but it's a copy of the cooperation agreement between the Swedish government and the US, which was signed in 2007, and I think it emerged in 2009. And again, it's one of those documents you never really expect to see, but it contains in it the protocols through which presumably data under the FRA law in Sweden is being exchanged with the NSA. And there's nothing in there about privacy protection. Literally, the word privacy doesn't feature. And I think it's really a case for human rights litigation. What seems to be happening is you have a security establishment, some people call them securocrats, in each government. And they have essentially been running this policy area because of the terrorism mantra autonomously. They've been spending vast amounts of public money building things like Tempora and completely out of control, at least in the sense that most people or most members of parliament in the legislatures of the countries concerned have had no idea about the scale or nature of these operations. So there's something just problematic about the way in which parliamentary oversight of this area works today in any country in Europe. And I don't know what the solution is, but I mean, I think we're in the most interesting times for covert surveillance policy, certainly for 13 years, possibly for 25 years. So it really is that remarkable an event we're going through. And I think everyone's got to really evaluate what the sort of strategic political possibilities are. And I'm still trying to do that myself. So I'm afraid I don't have a magic prescription, but it does seem almost a case of some sort of democratic movement against the securocracy, the state within the state, inside every state, who have decided to cooperate in ways which not only haven't been obvious to the parliaments of the countries concerned, but in many cases not even to the ministers.
We all know about America, but presumably any country that has a transatlantic cable arriving on its shore can stick a splitter on that. And okay, they may have problems with encrypted traffic because they can't do what the Americans are doing, but they can certainly see who's talking to who, even if it's encrypted, and they can see all the plain text traffic as well. Is there any evidence that other nations like China or Russia are doing the same kind of thing? And also, if they are, what on earth do we do about that?
Yes, I mean, so I think, I mean, I'd be amazed if China and Russia wasn't doing it. Of course, the question for Europe is how much American data is in Europe versus European data in American control, or indeed other nationalities' control. I haven't talked today about India. In fact, there is two very interesting paragraphs in the Indian IT Acts of 2007 and 2011 Amendment Acts, which basically say, in one paragraph, what FISA says at enormous tedious length. So the Indian Acts are quite as powerful in terms of their mass surveillance law as the FISA Act, with the exception that they don't have that nationality discrimination. That isn't there in the Indian Act. But in terms of being able to have this sweeping access to content, and indeed the Indian legislation mentions the word expedient when the government thinks it's expedient, that's there. And on my travels for Microsoft, I certainly met with one government that sort of wanted to become a sort of regional center for cloud computing and they talked about their national ambition of being an intelligence conning tower for the region. And I was very taken aback, you know, when I thought I was having a business meeting, and this sort of guy started telling me about that country's future intelligence strategy, and I said, check, that's really what you're talking about? And I said, yes, yes, wait, why does that seem so? I think we should take as absolutely matter of fact that countries that seem to be very interested in cloud computing have this on their agenda as part of their national policy.
Because in that case, you could have like a data Guantanamo kind of situation where the Americans say, okay, we're going to stop doing this in our own data centers and stuff, but okay, you'd need somewhere with a cable that was having a large amount of traffic through it, but they could get other nations to spy on their behalf, and then it wouldn't be covered by any laws or anything.
Absolutely, and I think sort of part of that has already come out from the other Snowden material, is what often will happen is there is a big global telecommunications company that has deals done in certain parts of the world, then deals will be done with that communications company and probably the government concerned, so that, for example, on the left hand, they will sell them a sort of top to bottom e-government solution or a communications switch management solution, and on the right hand say, well, here's the suite of analytics that you need to spy the crap out of your population as well and maintain social control. And it's done as a sort of 1-2 business deal. I have also elsewhere described the effect of the FISA law in general as creating a privacy Guantanamo, because it's essentially the same idea. What happened really with the deterioration of the legal model for data protection I described is for 40 years, pretty much going back to the start of these legal agreements, we had a situation where the territory of a country was roughly congruent with its jurisdiction. And that was really your only redress as an individual, to try and get access to that country's courts if something went wrong. And what cloud processing has done is just separated them entirely. And the situation is that the US does not recognize our rights in their jurisdiction. It's that simple. And that's why I fear that, you know, if we go down the road of this Article 42 restoration, Parliament will pat itself on the back and think job done, but actually nothing will change. So what we really have to do is get tough with the US and think about effectively a privacy barrier where we can create space for our own indigenous vertical cloud software industry to develop. So we can have major brands, major consumer services, major business cloud stacks, hopefully based on free software, which can then actually commercially compete in due course. And the analogy I give is with something like Airbus. Airbus has been through many commercial disasters over 20 years, but now it has 50% global market share in airliners. So you could say, why wouldn't Europe want to do that anyway? I mean, forget privacy, but cloud computing is obviously such an important future business. And the way things are at the moment is the high value of so-called analytics of all of this data, whether that's for designing advertising auctions or just direct marketing and profiling, all of that high value is being creamed off. So it simply makes economic good sense for Europe to develop its own autonomous cloud capacity, aside from all the privacy stuff.
Thank you, at first. I just wanted to share a personal thought, and not really a question, but I'm a little bit scared that many people who even didn't understand a bit about privacy, especially online privacy at first, are now even more ignorant. For example, I've been trying for years to tell friends and family, don't use Gmail because of Google in the terms of service. They state, yeah, we can reach your mail if you use our service. When I would talk about this issue now, after the Prism, they would probably confuse Google's terms of service with Prism. So, being more ignorant as well. So it's going to be maybe a negative side effect of the whole Prism thing is that people would even understand privacy less instead of more, and value it even less instead of more.
So yeah, I mean, to elaborate on the question, I mean, I've been struck often over many years by when one reads reactions to newspaper articles, for example, in the comments in online fora, they're very often polarized between people who say, well, of course, in anything you put on the internet, I mean, I've expected the Americans to be spying this. I mean, anyone who doesn't think that is a fool. and other people who are shocked, you know, and saying, what on earth is the point of this data protection law if all of this is in fact possible? And somehow, maybe there are opinions in between, but they don't bother to comment. Maybe it's something like that. I mean, I think that Snowden has said that, you know, his nightmare, if you like, is that he's revealed all of this stuff, and supposing nobody cares, supposing nothing changes. And I have a fear about this too. I mean, if we now are maybe at the zenith of the public concern, but maybe it has to get much more serious still for anything to change. And in a sense, if we are at the zenith now, and if we see still a lack of political will by member states particularly to do anything about this, then if Europe doesn't do anything about this, who else in the world will? Will we look back in a year's time and now then just be shrugging our shoulders and say, well, we're just living in an American surveillance hegemony and that's the way the world is? Yeah. And I think there's a real risk of that.
Thanks.
How do you think about the European Parliament now putting the espionage out of the investigation? I think we have the problem, espionage is not covered by data protection laws, but I think it is a very important part of this scandal we are looking at.
Yes, I'm not quite sure how to interpret that. I've been wondering. I mean, in terms of its practical effects, I mean, I think they were talking about having two committees or two committees of experts, one looking at espionage and the other looking at PRISM and FISA. And they're still going to have some committee looking at PRISM and FISA. But in a sense, I think the effect that we should be concerned about is not necessarily the fact they're not going to be investigating the espionage. I guess that was always kind of predictable. What also seems to have happened is who are these experts going to be looking at PRISA and FISA and PRISM? And certainly when I was talking to some contacts 2 weeks ago, after Reading had made this initial announcement, the idea seemed to be that some of these experts could be independent, and you know, they could be academics, or they could be at least people who were not part of government. But the idea seems to have changed, and the idea seems to be now that this committee of experts are going to be nominated government representatives, people with security clearances. In other words, part of the same securocracy that sort of gave you this in the first place. So I think we should be very worried about how the Commission intends to rely on these committees of experts on that particular inquiry. But on the other hand, we also have now this resolution from the European Parliament where they seem now definitely to have established the intention to have a parliamentary inquiry of some kind. So we don't know, again, how that's going to be run. Maybe it will be on the echelon inquiry lines. And I guess one could say, well, nothing ever happened about that. It's just a fact that the last meeting of the echelon committee in the European Parliament was on September the 10th, 2001. And I guess you can figure out why it never met after that. Anyone else? All right, well, thank you very much for your time.